This podcast was recorded on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Woi Wurrung people.
Merdeka! Merdeka! Merdeka!
The country of Indonesia.
Do they like me in Indonesia?
100% confident Indonesia will prevail.
Hello and welcome to Talking Indonesia. I am Tito Ambio from RMIT University. In this episode, we'll be hearing from Emeritus Professor Catherine Robinson, who in her long career as an anthropologist has looked at many different things: mining, religion, youth, and gender politics. In her latest book, Marriage, Migration, Intercultural Families, and Global Intimacies, her gaze is directed towards marriage between people from different countries, specifically between Asian women and Australian men. In her book, she looks at mostly women from the Philippines, but also with some case studies of Indonesian women. But the book is more than just about the Philippines or about Indonesia or Australia. And in this interview that you're about to hear, we will hear from Cathy about the things that we can learn from these families in creating intercultural spaces. We will also hear about damaging stereotypes that still haunt us about subservient Oriental women and the history of that stereotype. But more than that, Cathy, generous as always, shares her tips about how to be a good researcher about Indonesia these days. So look out for these tips. But first, I ask Cathy to tell us about how she started her career many years ago. And also, the interview was done in the corridors of RMIT, where I work, and it was completely my fault that I did not book a room, so we had to find a hallway that was quiet enough, but you will hear some echoes, and you will also hear RMIT students slamming some doors. I don't know what's with that. Can you tell us, how did you become interested in, as a way of introduction as well, how did you become interested in Indonesia? What was your PhD and what led you to writing about multiculturalism in Australia?
Well, in terms of how I got involved in doing research in Indonesia, when I finished university as an undergraduate, I went traveling and I spent quite a lot of time in Indonesia. And I'd studied Indonesian politics and Indonesian anthropology at the University of Sydney. But when I applied to the ANU, I actually applied to do research on Papua New Guinea. And then various things happened that made me feel a bit nervous about going there on my own as a female researcher. And Jim Fox was just newly appointed as a professor at ANU, and he was trying to build up the student numbers working on Indonesia. So he persuaded me that I should think about Indonesia, and I'd really enjoyed the time I'd spent travelling in Indonesia and felt very comfortable there. So that was kind of easy. And then at that time, America, that was in the mid-70s, and America was pulling back on its funding for Southeast Asian studies following the end of the Vietnam War. So quite a lot of people who'd been researchers at Cornell, well, it seemed like quite a lot, but there were some excellent researchers that ended up at the ANU because I guess their jobs had run out at Cornell. And one of them was Leonard Andaya, who had written a history of South Sulawesi. And Leonard, I got a summons to the tea room to meet Leonard. Someone said, oh, you've got to go and meet Leonard. He's got a great idea for a field site. And he'd heard about this Inco nickel project. And he knew it was in Luwu. And he thought it was closer to a sacred mountain called Cherekang than it was. But nonetheless, he was interested in that clash between this sort of sacred spaces of the Luwu kingdom and this modern industrial enterprise. And at that time, this is, you know, pre-internet days and all that, and I'd never heard of this mining project, but I had a friend who was a financial journalist who got in touch with the company here in Australia, so I got some hard copy material from the branch in Australia about this project. And because I was a politically active student who'd been involved in demonstrations against the Vietnam War and for Aboriginal land rights and so on. And at that time, there was a lot of discussion about anthropology as a kind of a colonial discipline that I was, you know, really vexed about and thinking about. And I thought, and I loved the idea of being an anthropologist, you know, the dirty boots aspects of it, of getting out there in the field and meeting people and curiosity about how other people live their lives. So I had decided that what I wanted to do was be an anthropologist who studied kind of neo-colonialism, if you like, was the term at the time, which is partly why I thought about going to Papua New Guinea as Australia's, by then, ex-colony. But anyway, this was perfect because I was getting ready to do my fieldwork in the late 70s, and the project had been opened by Suharto in the mid-70s, so it was still very new. And so I went there, and I guess, what do they say, the rest is history. And since then I've done a lot of research on different things in Indonesia. But I got interested in this project that's related to this book about multiculturalism, partly because of this ignorance of Indonesia in Australia, that I had a very nice colleague at Macquarie University where I was teaching, post-PhD, who was a psychologist and a feminist, and she asked me to write something for a journal because some of the editors were cranky about the fact that another of the editors had accepted an article by an Australian man married to a Filipina who was protesting about this negative stereotype that was starting to be thrown up in the mass media about the male order bride, you know, as if there was something illegitimate about these unions. And she didn't know the difference between the Philippines and Indonesia, so she but I'd noticed some of the negative publicity in the media. It was like what we now see as these horrible things on social media then were mostly in sort of tabloid journalism with dramatic headlines and so on. And so I was interested in the issue, and I was a strong feminist, you know, and without being getting a bit long-winded, but just, and I'd always been really interested in marriage as an institution, you know, because for us 1970s women's liberationists, it was a key institution that we were interested in, about where unequal gender relations were reproduced. But I'd had very interesting experiences as an anthropologist working in a situation in this mining town where they're on the cusp of moving from arranged marriage to free choice marriage. And it was very interesting because I'd have conversations with women about it, and it made me realise it wasn't as simple as I thought, you know, that my models from Australia were a bit simplistic in terms of understanding what the significance of arranged marriage is, and, you know, how it's not necessarily the case that free choice marriage good, arranged marriage bad, you know. And the discussions I had with these women about how they felt about it, I mean, they'd say things like, you know, if your parents arrange your marriage and if the man turns out to be no good and he doesn't support you and your children, they're responsible as well. You know, you're not on your own. That kind of thing that made me really think about, you know, women's rights and how they get reproduced in society and how institutions like marriage relate to those rights. Yeah. So anyway, so I was already interested in marriage, and I also thought that none of this media debate about the so-called, you know, sexy Asian women marrying loser Australian men got nowhere near what I thought would be the really interesting issues about how do they negotiate their ideas about spousal responsibilities, how do they negotiate different assumptions about how you relate to extended family members, how do they negotiate their own children but also their relationships to children from previous marriages, you know, how do they negotiate, you know, so that idea, I think you'd say, as I say in the book now, the family as an intercultural space. That's how I got interested, and I've had a trailing interest in this topic ever since. That was in the 1980s, 81 I think I first wrote about it.
Yeah. And in the book you talk about stereotypes, like, yes, what you mentioned before, especially when in Australia, when we see an Asian woman with an Australian man, there are still these stereotypes.
Exactly.
What are these stereotypes and what are their histories?
Yeah, I think that's really true, that there's still this assumption, like, and I've had lots of experiences of friends telling me these things, like an Indonesian woman I know that was married to one of my Australian students, for example, And when they walked down the street in Kuta, she'd always walk behind him. And she explained to me it was because everyone treated her like she was a prostitute, you know, because she was with a white man. And he was very naive, this guy, and he said, oh, I thought it was because the streets were narrow. But that's an example, you know, but there's that kind of suspicion that falls on Asian women married, and the men too, you know, the men are seen as these losers that can't shape up to a, you know, red-blooded Australian woman or some goddamn, you know, something like that. So I think the stereotypes are very pervasive. What I try and argue in the book is that Australia has had a whole history of these periods of sex imbalances, you know, so that in the book I go back to colonial settlement and the way that the initial settlement of Australia by, or New South Wales in particular, and by convicts, the balance was clearly majority men, very little women. And the colony, it was a terrible place in terms of gender relations, as we call it now, you know, that the women were just sexual prey. And Anne Summers in the 1970s wrote a book called Damned Whores and God's Police, about the beginning of this stereotype. You know, the women were seen as fair game. And the this beginning of importing women to correct these demographic imbalances began in that period where women would be, including some of my own ancestors, were encouraged to come to the colony as domestic servants. You know, women who were, apart from the few women convicts, there were women free settlers who came as domestic servants. And but the, behind that there was this idea that they'd have a civilising influence and that they'd marry and start reproducing to people this empty continent. You know?
And this went back all the way to the First Fleet, right?
All the way back to the First Fleet. And if you read Robert Hughes's book, The Fatal Shore, some absolutely shocking things that he quotes from accounts of the time of, you know, women getting off these ships and basically being chased around by men, you know, to rape them. I mean, just shocking. Or they were lined up at a place called the Female Factory, where they were married off like an auction, you know, married off to men who wanted a sex partner but also wanted labour as they started to have people moving out, you know, convicts who were released to establish farms, that kind of thing. It was only in 1975 that you started to have significant amounts of Asian migration with the Vietnamese boat refugees that the Prime Minister at the time saw as an Australian responsibility, because we fought in the war, you know, so we had a responsibility. And around that same time too, you started having Muslim Lebanese coming from the Civil War. So this really was an incredible sort of shake-up. And again, there was lots of media hysteria about, you know, the frontline suburbs and, you know, the race politics, and there'd be fights in the street. So the mail order bride thing has also a connection to that Vietnam War history, because a lot of the kind of brokered relationships and men going to the Philippines looking for partners was a little bit tied up in its genesis with the sex industries or the entertainment industries that grew up around the American air bases in Thailand and the Philippines. It's very difficult. In fact, in my book, I talk a little bit about some Indonesian Australian marriages, and because I live in Canberra and there were people in Canberra who are my friends and my friendship group, it's a very different group from the people we studied, you know, who were the people who'd formed these marriages through correspondence in rural areas. The Indonesian women married to Australians in Canberra tend to be professionals who met their husbands either because they were studying together or they were working in the same place, either in Australia or Indonesia. Yeah. But one of those women, for example, told me that she eventually took the very difficult decision of giving up her Indonesian citizenship and taking up Australian citizenship because she got sick of immigration officials treating her like she's a prostitute, you know, every time she'd cut. So this this stereotype is very kind of deep.
And how does it play out now? Because you, in your book, you also talk about online sites, right? I mean, you're not talking about dating apps because your research was before the days of dating apps. But there was all these websites like Phil West, is it?
So there were a lot of websites. I think what happened was that you had this, you know, there's always these people who see a way to make a buck. And so there were these websites. Initially, these so-called mail order bride relationships were formed through snail mail correspondence, you know, that people would advertise in certain journals.
Yeah.
Like one was called People and there was another one called The Australian Singles, like newspapers or magazines. And then you'd have a pen pal correspondence and then, you know, see if anything came out of any of those correspondences. But of course, once you had the beginnings of the internet, a lot of it shifted to the internet.
Mm.
And these people set up these sites, which there's been a lot of cultural studies analysis of these sites where they just look at the sites and they don't look beyond them to the relationships. But the women, they are advertised like a handbag in a catalogue or something like that, you know, like the women's pictures there and a little bit about her and so forth. But you also had some, one of the people who was involved in one of these online relationships that was in our study, it had been a site set up by the church in the US and they didn't allow people to have pictures because they thought this would somehow try to contain this lasciviousness, I suppose.
Right.
So that's where. But the other thing we found was, of course, when you start to look at the expansion of the internet and the internet as a space where people have, where social relations take place, of course, a lot of the people that we found who had internet-mediated relationships, correspondence and so on, they didn't meet on these dating sites. A lot of them would be in like a chat room that was a hobby-based chat room or something like that.
Oh.
And therefore they'd, you know, they'd find someone who they were simpatico with because they liked the same kind of music or something like that. And then that the relationship would develop that way.
The image of mail order brides seems like it's very one way, right? There's a group of men, lonely men in Australia, ordering women from overseas.
That's right.
But that's not what you found, right? It's a two-way thing.
It's a two-way thing. Like the stereotype is also definitely in the 80s, there was a bit of this stereotype. They were loser men who couldn't shape up to a red-blooded Australian woman, you know, that kind of thing. But in fact, this demographic imbalance has been a continuing feature of Australia's development, you know, like in the post-World War II period, when you had a big agenda to develop what they used to talk about as the empty continent, you know.
Mm.
They brought in a lot of migrants from Southern Europe for construction, like home construction, the Snowy Mountain Authority opening up the mines in Australia's interior and so on. And if you do that, what do you end up with? You end up with these communities that are largely single sex. The migrants that are brought in are often not highly educated, probably don't speak English. So even if there are women in their orbit that they can mix with, in these very demographically unbalanced communities, they're not going to have an easy time to marry and have a family.
Mm.
If we think about that as being, you know, something that's a right of social citizenship, you know, that people can have those aspirations. And so a lot of the first sort of snail mail, mail order bride relationships were from places like Mount Isa, you know, where you had these very much demographically unbalanced community. It's not men looking for sex slaves, it's men looking for partners.
Yeah.
And the same on the women's side. They're looking for partnership. They're also, a lot of them are women who might already have children. I'm just generalizing here, but they might either still have children from a previous marriage, or they've got families in the Philippines that they're responsible for. So there's a bundle of things that go into people's expectations about what they'll get out of these relationships.
Mm.
But being able to support your already existing children prior to the marriage, to support your family in the Philippines, that's a motive too. So in terms of this idea about the family as an intercultural space, they're the kind of issues that get debated. What's the new husband's responsibility for those children and their families? How does that household and its economy respond to those expectations? You know, they're the interesting questions about how people work out those aspects of their lives.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we've been talking about the courtship so far, right?
Yes.
But then that's just the beginning because now, I want to ask you the questions about how do these families function, especially for listeners who have never been to Australia, for example?
Yes.
Can you describe the challenges and the stories of especially Indonesian women who are here, who've married Australian partners? What are their lives like?
Well, see, I've just got my friends in Canberra and they have very nice lives because they've got this social group where the husbands come along. You know, and I think I've seen the same a lot with Filipinas. They establish it's like a quasi-kin network where they enjoy enacting Indonesian culture, eating Indonesian food, relating to people in terms of Indonesian sociality, you know, that kind of thing, where they can recreate their own ways of being in the world. And the husbands kind of get drawn in, you know, and I think that's common. I had a colleague years ago who was married to a Thai woman. And he said to me, he said, you know, I go to all these activities that are organised by the Thai women as a group, and they're like family functions. And he said, and you know, those men I meet there, they're a bit like your brother-in-law, you know, that if you want to repair the garage or something, you can call on them. They're not your best mates, but you can call on them, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I think that explains it really well. And you know, you get some, of course you get issues. I mean, I think the difference is if we think about these families as intercultural spaces, you get some of the issues that you could say have roots in different cultures, like expectations about being wives or being husbands or being parents. They have to be kind of negotiated and sorted, you know.
What are some of the issues that you've seen?
Well, money. So they'll have to negotiate these issues about whether the money that the woman earns is hers to be sent to her family, which is one extreme, or whether the resources are family resources that need to be expended through mutual decision making. That's issues about children. But it's interesting, we did some interviews with children, and when you asked about things like discipline, it was really the children didn't have the sense of themselves as, you know, that's their family and that's their mum and that's their dad, you know? And if they had a sense about any difference in discipline strategies, it tended to be, that one parent was strict and one wasn't, but they didn't relate it to their parents' cultural background. But the thing I thought was very cute with the children of the Filipinas, when you'd say to the children, well, what, you know, tell me about your mum, what about your mum, and whatever, they'd say, oh, she makes great lumpia. And all the children want to come and eat lumpia and all that. And, when we had the school fete, my mum's stall with the lumpia, that made the most money, you know. And then, of course, you know, the issues about how they relate back to the families in the Philippines, those are things that come into negotiation. I think the same in Indonesia, you know, how they... But the children often like having these cosmopolitan relationships. They feel proud of the fact that they've got connections overseas. And I know one of my son's best friends from Canberra is the son of an Indonesian mother and Australian father. And I know, for example, he had, as a teenager, he had a very lively relationship with his cousins in Indonesia in terms of pop music, you know, great slang fan, and, you know, all that kind of thing, you know, and it was something that, it sort of enhanced his life and he, you know, made him special that he had this relationship.
One of the things I really enjoyed reading the book is, you know, this kind of imagining what it's like to be in that space in an intercultural family, transnational family. Why is it important that we learn about these intercultural families?
Well, I suppose we come back to the stereotypes, you know, that the stereotype is about a totally sexualized idea of a relationship. You know, and I think it's important to know about these families because that's not what it's about. You know, it's about people establishing households and families and having everyday lives in their communities. So that's why I think it's important.
What about in terms of multiculturalism in general? What can we learn from these families about how to live in a multicultural society?
Yeah, I think with these families, a lot of the issues that relate to multiculturalism are the same as the issues for, you know, people who are from other cultures, non-white Australian cultures, trying to make their way here. And I think that whole shift to multiculturalism in the 1980s has been really important because it values... I mean, I know you can be critical of it, like Ghassan Haj says, you know, it's a collection, you know, it's Australia's, it's our multiculturalism, you know, we white Australians own it. But there's a lot of ownership too by those people, and the Filipinas in Australia, and Mina Roses has written about this in her work on Mount Isa as well, they enjoy showcasing their culture, showcasing their dances. Like one of the women in our study said, I said I was going to do Filipina dancing and they all thought I was going to do pole dancing. You know, that's the stereotype. And then they were amazed to see this beautiful, graceful dancing, you know. And food, you know, because food is so important in so many cultures, you know, commensality and whatever. And like Nicola Frost has done research with Indonesian women in Sydney who are in Indonesian families. And she talks about the great pride and joy they have in first running cooking classes for people, teaching them how to cook Indonesian food, but then setting up their food stalls, including at multicultural festivals. So they see this as a way to outreach. And yeah, maybe it is, you know, a lot of Anglo-Australians do have a fairly limited sense of how they're negotiating these relationships, but you know, they do feel pride in the fact that they can go to a multicultural festival, or you know, and that they can eat this beautiful food, and the people from different cultures in Australia are there represented in a very positive light. In fact, in that context, Australia, white Australia, is a site of lack. Because, you know, what do you have? What is there? What would you say was the equivalent? So sometimes there's a fallback on Indigenous culture, but, you know, that's problematic. But
now, to move to another kind of topic that's related to your book as well, your book is a collection of, well, in terms of the methodology of your research, you're a very experienced anthropologist. You've done lots of field work in the past. But you're also pretty comfortable with digital ethnography, using, you know, looking at websites, etc. Do you have any kind of tips for people who are interested in doing research? Because these days Indonesians are very active online, right? And a lot of our listeners are doing research about Indonesia. How do you navigate that? How do you use online sites as a field to study?
Well, I guess it's the same sorts of rules as, for me anyway, as when you do ethnography, that you let people know who you are and what you're doing, and you relate to them as a person. Like the internet allows the possibility for lurking in a lot of these sites, and that's not really legitimate, I don't think, because also if you don't engage with the people, you've got no idea about why they're posting or doing what they're doing. Like the great old rule that I learned as an undergraduate anthropologist was that we're interested in what people say, what they do, and what they say about what they do. Well, if you go online and you lurk, you're only seeing what people say about what they do. You know, you don't have any of that broader context. And maybe that's what you're interested in. I don't know. But to me, it's not really giving you that kind of knowledge. So I think people I know that are getting heavily into doing research with people and are interested, well, they're interested in the ways that people use digital space. And like, I'm quite critical of the cultural studies articles that were published in the late 80s, early 90s, all about these mail order sites, because they don't get at anything about the real human beings involved. You know, it's very thin, it's very easy to do content analysis of the websites. You know, and they tell you something, but they don't tell you everything. But people I know that are doing a lot of digital ethnography, you know, they make an effort to try and actually meet the people or put their online activities in some sort of broader context. And not take it as sui generis, you know, as if there's nothing behind it.
There's a part in your book where you describe meeting the word feminazi for the first time.
Oh, yes, that's right.
What was that like?
That was on one of these websites, and I've seen it a lot since, but that was this guy, Gary Clark, who had this website, and he was a great, real ideologue, you know, I suppose that's the other side of the story, that you did have ideologues like him promoting this idea of Asian women as passive and sexy and, you know, all the things that Western feminist women, feminazis, weren't, you know, and it plays a little bit. I wrote another article actually a few years ago around a contest between a Malaysian so-called prince, I don't know if you ever followed that story, who was married to a woman here in Melbourne actually, and he kidnapped the children. I called the article, I use boys' own tales in that, you know, that they loved his heroism. And I think a lot of it was around, there is a little discourse that goes on amongst some of those men that Asia is a site of strong family values in their romanticised and unrealistic vision of what, you know, like this homesteader movement in the US, you know, the little wife at home just doing the cooking and all of that kind of thing.
Yeah, the trad wives.
The trad wives, yes. The fantasy that's what, it's a fantasy. It's like a, you know, the fake evolutionary kind of schemas that says that's traditional and somehow that's where we all came from. And it's not true. I mean, you know, if you looked at the family dynamics it differs all over Indonesia, you know, because you've got all sorts of different kinship systems and all of that kind of thing. But women aren't these passive objects that sit at home and wear pretty dresses and, you know.
And, of course, you've met many, many amazing, strong Indonesian women as well.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, exactly. And, I mean, the other day, for example, I gave a talk in Canberra where I wanted to remind them all about a figure like Nafsir Mboy, who was the governor's wife in NTT between, I think, was it 77 and 89, something like that, and who, as governor's wife, under the sort of Ibuism of the New Order government, was the head of Dharma Wanita and blah, blah, blah. But this woman who was a paediatrician, she could use that, you know, and I've met several women over the years who might be my friends, who've been in that kind of position where they've had to formally be heads of Dharma Wanita, but they're professional women, and they use it not to, you know, pyramid sell pots and pans, but to, you know, to actually educate women, and the women are hungry for that, you know. So I think, and I just wanted to remind everyone of Ibu Nafsir as this woman who had an extraordinary impact in terms of her, you know, working with her husband as governor, but to do programs to improve health and women's and children's well-being, but also to empower these women. You know, I was in NTT about 10 years after she'd been there, and I met these women who she was still mentoring, you know, to be active in local politics and do their thing and how to do gender analysis. And, you know, and if you just looked at the ideology of the New Order and didn't go beyond it, you'd have a very different picture about, and people still get sucked in by that. They still think Indonesia traditionally has these unequal domestic relationships. Not true.
And it is interesting you mentioned Dharma Wanita, this stereotype of the subservient Oriental women.
Yes.
It's also alive in Indonesia.
Exactly. I think this is a problem. And I was quite interested when we had the Indonesia update last year or the year before, on the issue of, you know, gender relations in post-Suharto. And it seemed to me that several of the papers talked about the enduring power of the New Order stereotypes. Because, you know, a lot of effort was put into, because I argue in stuff I've written that, you know, it was basically an authoritarian regime, and like all authoritarian regimes, they use the family as a model for the nation. So the patriarch in the family is part of the ideological legitimation, is that men are heads of households, which of course the Sahara government enshrined in law, with all sorts of dysfunctional consequences in terms of government and social programs and so on. But people still, it's really powerful and it's very difficult to get rid of. And I think legally that law is still in, I think it's in the marriage law, that men are the heads of households legally. you know, which is kind of weird, you know.
Yeah.
And it was so strongly socialized, as they like to desocialisasi, as they like to say in Indonesia. Very difficult to shift.
Yeah.
But then, so that's on the one hand. But on the other hand, you've got these examples of people like Nafsiran Boy, who were incredibly strong women, and who managed to do really incredible things in terms of the empowerment of women under the umbrella of that oppressive ideology.
And it is interesting because I recently watched two horror films. One is called Sehidup Semati and the other one is called Sijin. It's actually a horror film about unfaithful husbands.
Ah.
Do you think we are starting to change, or women are starting to change the way they look at marriages and the roles of women, or that stereotype of being, you know, the subservient, you know, Eastern, you know, Budaya Timur? Is it changing now in Indonesia?
I think a lot of things contribute to how those kinds of relationships change, you know. Not the least of it being broader shifts in demography. You know, like, for example, you know, the kinds of houses, you know, in the real estate that middle-class Indonesian families live in, they condition particular kinds of family relationships, you know, like the nuclear family. And so I think those things are really important in terms of the relationships between men and women. You wonder about, after the fall of the New Order, I was very interested how all sorts of things were shaken out. Like for example, you had that peculiar thing under the New Order, maybe partly because of this importance of the patriarch, the single patriarch, you know, the antipathy to polygamy.
And
which I think but people sometimes attribute it to Ibu Tien, you know, that she was the origin of the Pepe Sepulu that limited the rights to polygamy of civil servant men, you know. But you had all those guys, you know, Puspa Wadoyo was the most famous, you know, coming out and sort of arguing for, oh, this is my religious right, et cetera, et cetera. Really strongly countered by women. But then also you had a very facetious column by Julia Surya Kusuma, which shocked some of these men I know in Australia, these men who study Indonesia, where she said, I want to be a second wife. I want to be a second wife because someone else can urus my suami. You know, which is like a really different attitude. It's not saying, oh, poor, poor, pitiful me. But so I think those kinds of things are all part of a sort of a public discourse. And also I think I could be wrong here, but I have a feeling that the never married is increasing in Indonesia. You know, that some people are just saying, not for me, I've got other things I want to do with my life.
Yeah. Lastly, I just want to ask you, a few days ago we celebrated Hari Kartini.
Hari Kartini, yes.
And in one of your articles you argue that Kartini is a floating signifier that people keep using. How should we use the story of Kartini today, just, you know, just to help us celebrate Kartini in the modern era?
Oh, I guess the way I've seen young people use it is they see, this is a shocking generalization, but for some young people, Kartini is a signifier of women doing something that women have never done before. And I think that's really interesting. So I've seen these images, for example, of these young women climbing a mountain and when they get to the top, whipping out their kebayas, you know, and enacting a kind of a Kartini persona because they've climbed to the top of this mountain, which no other women had done before.
Just finally, you know, you are now retired.
Yeah.
You've enjoyed a long, successful career in researching about Indonesia and other places. What do you want to say to those researchers who are just starting their career researching in Indonesia or about Indonesia? What do you want to say to them?
I suppose one thing I would say would be really be attentive to history, because there has been a great tradition in Indonesia of official excising of history. I remember once when I was in Indonesia in the 1980s, some people were organising a conference on the 1950s because it had all been forgotten and it's not taught in schools anymore. And so I think there's a real need to really understand history. because, like, I'm an anthropologist, so I deal in the here and now, but it's really important to understand, like in my book, I've said it's really important to understand Australian history and the history of white Australia and white Australia consciousness to understand why these despicable kind of stereotypes arise.
Yeah.
So I suppose I'd say that as a general thing, just kind of have a bit of a deep dive into history, which is kind of difficult because I was just on a meeting the other day where about Indonesian studies in Australia, where it was pointed out that in a way historical studies of Indonesia in Australia are almost like a thing of the past. You know, there's not a whole new generation of historians being created. Now, I hope that's happening in Indonesia, but I also just read David Reeves' biography of Ong Hock Ham, which is very interesting. That is very interesting because it's very interesting for the history and the intellectual history of Indonesia. I mean, it's about a lot of things, but it's a wonderful book. But it also really makes you think about those different currents of the way history's been taught in Indonesia. So anyway, that would be my plea. Make yourself a bit, even if you're not a historian, make yourself a bit familiar with history. Yeah.